Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namāsāmi. One of the most useful and simple teachings of the Buddha. He didn't have to deal with microphones. One of the most simple and useful teachings of the Buddha was what is called the teaching of the arrow, or the two arrows. And this is in relationship to physical pain. And he uses the simile of a soldier being shot on a battlefield. And, he says physical pain, the experience of... Oh, by the way, I think you can leave the notebooks down and just listen. So, but, I would encourage that. So... physical pain is something we all experience, whether you are a young child or an old person, whether you are totally enlightened or whether you are just an average unawakened being. We all experience physical pain. Having a body has sensations, and so we have pleasant feelings, painful feelings, neutral feelings. So the Buddha said that the very fact that this body experiences physical pain is that with that comes discomfort, but it's also possible for us to live with that painful feeling without adding anything to it. The second arrow is what the mind adds to that physical pain, the feelings of resentment, of fear. By the way, our friend in the corner on the windowsill, if you could put the notebook down. Thank you. So, the second arrow is the anguishing, negotiating, fretting, fearing, worrying about that physical pain, what the mind adds to it. And in this simile, the Buddha pointed out that the first arrow is non-negotiable. You have, as long as you have a body and have a mind, we're going to experience physical pain. That's intrinsic in the mix. The second arrow we can dodge. That if we're mindful, if we're awake, then we can avoid the second arrow. Now this is a very simple but extremely significant teaching, because the mind immediately reacts to discomfort by, as we all know, just sitting together for, you know, the last day. I'm sure we've all had experiences of physical pain, and the mind easily moves to, oh, what's going to happen? Is it going to get worse? Oh dear, what's going on in my knee? When's this going to be over? Stressing, fretting, tensing up, and anguishing about the discomfort. Oh, in this simple teaching, what he points to is that the physical pain in and of itself is not does not produce a state of suffering. It's uncomfortable, but the suffering, the dukkha, is what the mind adds to it. So the teaching of the Four Noble Truths, the dukkha that we talk about, the suffering that we talk about being brought to an end, is that the suffering of the second arrow. It's like that even though we might experience physical pain, the mind can be completely at peace with that. If you're worrying now that I'm going to institute like a 4-hour sitting where no one's allowed to move, then don't worry, I'm not going to do that. But rather, to see how that when we are experiencing physical pain, there's a possibility in the attitude that we have towards that to just know that pain as a feeling, and to relax the attitude towards it, to relax the body around it. So say, for example, when we're sitting together and you feel pain in your knee or your back or wherever it might be, first of all, rather than thinking of that, the pain interrupting your meditation, and that, oh, I wish this would go away, I can get back to my breath, get back to the practice. Instead, we can actually make the feeling of discomfort the object of our attention, and bringing the mind to that, let's say the feeling of pain in the knee, then we can notice how much the body tenses up against that, so that we feel pain, and so then the body resists that and stresses as a natural reaction to physical discomfort, and yet we don't realize that very tensing up increases the causes of pain in the body. We bring more tension into the system and we create greater causes for pain. So what we discover is that if you bring attention to that the place where you're feeling the pain, and you relax the muscles around there, like if it's pain in your knee, to relax the muscles in your legs and your hip joints and the whole lower area of the body, and particularly around the joint itself, you begin to see the causes of pain are reduced, they're diminished. And then even so, maybe a level 7 pain goes down to a level 4 pain, but even that the level 4 pain, you realize that that is an uncomfortable presence in the mind, but it's not something that we have to hate, it's not something that we have to fear, and there can be an attitude of acceptance. So yesterday I was talking a lot about loving kindness and a radical acceptance. So to have loving kindness doesn't mean to say that we're trying to pretend that we like pain, or, oh, how marvelous, it's that agony in my knee again, oh, jolly good, hello, welcome back. Yeah. It's not so much that at all, but you're not pretending to like the unlikable, but you're recognizing here it is. And so that we begin to see that the pain is one thing, and what the mind adds to it is another. And just as there can be the discomfort in your knee, and then the body tensing up against it, or we can relax, and you know the discomfort is still there, we can also change the attitude towards it, whereby we don't create hatred towards it, we don't feed a sense of fear or anxiety about it. It's just simply present. And so the usual encouragement around sitting meditation that our teacher Ajahn Chah would give would be to say, when you feel pain in the body and you want to change your posture, then always stay with it for a few minutes before you shift your posture. So what I like to put a qualifier on that as well, to say, you know, it's fine to change your posture, but it's very important and very helpful to wait, to work with your attitude, to work with relaxing the body first of all, and then to work with your attitude so that there's a quality of acceptance, a relaxation of the body, an attitude of an acceptance towards the pain. And then what you're able to do is to have much more of an accepting, spacious relationship towards that feeling. And then your own intuition of what the body's limits are can function more accurately, so that then you know, okay, I've been sitting with this pain in my knee for about 10 minutes, and I think that's just about enough. I don't want another trip to the emergency room. Yeah, had surgery 2 years ago, so let's say that's a limit there. Draw a line under it. So you're not forcing yourself just out of sheer will to endure something that is in the long term injurious to the body, but you're not just reacting in a blind way to the discomfort, but more you're feeling your body's own intelligence. You're letting your body's own intelligence, its own natural systems, function in a in an unobstructed way. And so then you, by being open and attentive, then you can feel when enough is enough, just like with food. You know, if you pay attention as you're eating, your body knows, okay, that's enough. You know, you're interested in the food when you're hungry and you're eating, and then if you're not completely entranced by the flavors or the act of eating or the conversation that you're having, you just pay attention to the act of eating itself, then again, your body's own intelligence steps in and says, okay, that's enough. Yeah, put the put your spoon down and call it quits. You know, our whole system has its own wisdom, its own intelligence, if we listen for it. So in this respect, the way that we relate to pain can be changed in a radical way, so that rather than hating it and fearing it and trying to get away from it and then trying to invest in places where we're not feeling it, rather we see that peace or freedom doesn't come from an absence of pain, but it comes from letting go of the negativity, the fear, the negotiating and the fretting around it, which we, in this simile of the Buddha, we would call the second arrow. We can dodge the second arrow, or as you often see in bumper stickers or t-shirts here in California, pain is inevitable, but suffering is optional. This being Bay Area, you know? They have those kind of bumper stickers, haven't quite made it to England yet, but it's even though you might see it on a bumper sticker or a t-shirt or stuck on a fridge magnet, there's a lot of wisdom there. That's a very valid and useful perspective. And the Buddha pointed right to this as a very significant teaching. The usefulness of this is not just within the realm of physical pain, because of course physical pain and mental pain are very closely related. And even though this principle can be seen to work on the level of physical pain, it can, or you can also, in the meditation, you can see how it works with mental pain also, the uncomfortable and difficult mind states, feelings of regret, or feelings of sadness, of grief, or feelings of anger or fear, or any kind of painful or difficult emotional state, obsessive thoughts or unresolved doubts and conflicts that we experience. These are uncomfortable mental states. They're painful mental states, but they work in exactly the same way. That it's not the quality of the emotion itself that is problematic, but the attitude that we have towards it. And so it's very interesting in the Satipatthana Sutta, the Buddha's main teaching on meditation that informs the Theravada, the Southern Buddhist tradition, main teaching on mindfulness and meditation practice. The third section of that is called Cittanupassana, the mindfulness of moods or mind states. And in that he outlines this variety of different states, saying knowing the angry mind is angry, knowing the mind free of anger is free of anger. Knowing the agitated mind is agitated, the mind free of agitation is being free of agitation. Knowing the concentrated mind is concentrated, the unconcentrated, you know, the scattered mind is scattered. So in that particular sutta, that particular teaching, he makes no sort of moral or qualitative judgment. He doesn't say anger is worse than non-anger. He doesn't say that concentration is better than being scattered. He just says, knowing the scattered mind is scattered and the concentrated mind is concentrated. Knowing the agitated mind is agitated, the calm mind is calm. And that he points to the establishment of mindfulness is in a way independent of the particular quality. And that as long as there is mindfulness there, that, oh, this is the agitated mind or this is the angry mind, the degree to which that mindfulness is clear and established, then our mind will not get drawn in to that state. It won't buy into and embody, identify with that state. But it'll know, whoa, this is a busy one. Like, oh, this is painful. Yeah, and that that is a tremendous capacity that we have. And if we learn these kind of skills with the simplicity and directness of physical pain, then we find that we can apply these very useful lessons to the much more complex and testing realm of mental pain, of sadness and grief and the whole range of mental disquiet and disturbance that we can experience. I encourage this as we are spending this time together and having this time of sitting and walking together and living together in this place, using this time to see if you can tease those things apart, to see if you can distinguish between the first and the second arrow, and to see how the second arrow can be dodged, can be avoided, and the mind can live with an attitude of non-contention, even with something that we would really dislike, like physical pain, or feeling of grief, maybe someone who close to you has passed away, or feelings of resentment or anger. Maybe you've had an argument with someone at your work, or you've been fired from your job, and you're full of righteous indignation. How dare they treat me that way? Or you're worried about whether some business deal is going to go through or not going to go through, and we can see if we, by watching those waves of feeling come through the mind, remembering that conflict or that seeing that those kinds of emotions arising, to be able to recognize, well, this is the feeling of fear, or this is the feeling of worry about, is that deal going to work, or this is the feeling of resentment. This is the how dare they? It's the how dare they feeling. That's what this is. And you're not pushing it away. You're not justifying it. You're not wallowing in it. You're not trying to wipe it out. It arises. It has its characteristics, its quality, its shape, its form, and it passes away. And so that we begin to see how we can live in a sensitive and appreciative attitude towards those different aspects of our life, but not creating contention against them. And with a non-contentious attitude, then our wisdom faculty can function, so that we can see, okay, well, maybe there is resentment arising about that particular exchange or this particular situation, but let's not make that the deciding factor. What else is there playing into the picture? What else is there that's a part of this? And you're able to use your capacity to reflect, to look at the whole pattern of things, and to use your wisdom to say, guide your actions and speech in relationship to that situation. Today, just in terms of the meditation instruction that I've been giving, it's mostly just been in terms of the development of concentration or focus. But of course, that's not the only aspect of meditation. This place is called Insight IRC, Insight Retreat Center. Yeah. So obviously, Insight Vipassana meditation is a big thing here, I would imagine. So it's on the tea towels, it's there on the label, so it must be important. But sometimes within the Buddhist world, you can get this sense of, oh, we're a jhana outfit. We do concentration, and Vipassana, that's just the kind of, well, it's a kind of fake meditation, really. I mean, they like to think of it as insight. They call it that, but it's really just a lot of thinking. They just do that because they can't really meditate like us. They're not real kind of true jhana warriors like us. And then the Vipassana team say, well, they're just concentrators, really. They just know how to focus their mind, but they don't really have any wisdom. And if you think this is just a 2014 debate, this has been going on for a good couple of thousand years, since the Buddha's time itself. Even in the scriptures, you have this account of the Buddha talking to some of the monks, and they're asking about, well, when we have a big gathering, you know, how should we decide who stays in which kutis and who's going to live where in the forest? And the Buddha said, well, you put the Vipassana people in this section here, and you put the Dhyana people over there, and you put the reciters over there, and you put the ones who like to sit around and complain about everything over there. Not much has changed in the last 2,500 years. Human nature carries on. But one of the themes or characteristics of Ajahn Chah's approach towards meditation and practicing and teaching Dhamma was that he'll point out that, you know, the mind isn't really divided into samatha and vipassana. It's not divided into concentration and insight. It's all the same mind. You know, it's all this mind, and we're talking about particular attributes or particular capacities, and so you can take an idea, a way of labeling some particular thing, and you can say it's completely different. Like saying, you know, that's ice. You know, well, that's steam. It's like, yeah, that's a cloud. You know, that's a river. It was all water. You know, there's just different ways that water manifests, but it's all just water. There's no real difference between it. It's all made of the same stuff, but it takes different forms according to different conditions. And what he would always emphasize is that you know, samatha and vipassana, concentration and insight, they work together. And a very useful little simile that he would give would be to say it's like a candle. Yeah, so he said concentration, samatha, the ability to focus the mind, it's like a candle. You know, you've got a wick, and you've got a lot of wax, and you've got a candle, and you go into a dark place, and you've got your candle, but it's not much use if you haven't got a match, right? Holding your candle up, you know, there's a lot of potential there. You've got the wax, you've got the wick, but Without the match, without something to light the candle with, you can't really see. And he said, so samatha, concentration, is like a candle, but vipassana is like a match. You strike the match and you can see. It doesn't matter how dark it is or how long it's been dark. If you strike the match, then you can see what's going on in the space. But the match doesn't have very much fuel. It's just a little stick or a little kind of piece of card. And very quickly it burns away. And so insight, vipassana on its own, insight, yeah, it's valid. You know, you can see, you can understand. There's vision, there's clear seeing, but without much fuel, then that vision can't be sustained. But if you take the match, light the match, and then put it to the candle, then the fuel from the candle and the ignition from the match work together, so that you can carry your candle around and you can see clearly for a long time. I feel that's the most apt and useful way of understanding how concentration and insight work together. I'm also conscious of the fact that many of you are, you know, old-time Vipassana warriors have been doing this for decades and decades, and others have just walked into the theater, and this is all very new. And so just to talk a little bit about what we mean by insight or Vipassana. When we are developing the meditation and training the mind to focus on the present moment, then we are using a single object to help, say, bring the mind to steadiness, to an integration of attention, so that the attention rests easily in the present moment. So that focus brings a quality of peacefulness, of stillness, and there's an enjoyment and a clarity that comes with that focus of attention. But that focus, just having the mind still and clear and paying attention to the present, that isn't intrinsically liberating. It's not something that really frees the heart, because as soon as something comes along and disturbs the object or distracts the attention, then the mind is carried away. So vipassana, insight, the in, what's and the sight is looking into the very fabric of experience. So just as here we are in this hall, and we can say, here we are at IRC in the hills around Santa Cruz, and this is where we are. But this hall and this center is in our minds, I think I was talking about this yesterday evening, how in this moment, what we're experiencing, each and every one of us is experiencing our mind's representation of this moment. I don't see you, I see my mind's representation of you. So at the moment, I haven't got my glasses on. So the people in the chairs at the back there, I think that's Gowrie in the black waistcoat, but I can't be sure because I haven't got my glasses on. I put my glasses on, I think, oh, it is. She's nodding, I think, so I think that must be Gowrie. So if I put my glasses on, then I see more clearly. Yeah, it's if I close my eyes, the whole vanishes. Open my eyes, you all appear again. So in very simple ways, we can see that the mind is piecing together our version of this moment. And each one of us will have a different perspective according to our language, our conditioning, our education, our family, our gender, our age, our character traits, our personal experiences, you know, all of that, and the fact that we're human beings rather than spiders or ticks. Maybe there are some ticks in here we don't know about. That we experience this moment in this place in this way. But it's a compounded a pattern of experience, and it's conditioned, it's formed. As you say, it's just by closing your eyes, the visual element disappears. Open your eyes, it reappears. If I put my glasses on, I can see clearly at the back of the room. Without my glasses, it's all a bit fuzzy back there. So, Vipassana is recognizing that this moment is put together, it's pieced together from sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, memory, by patterns of a consciousness of seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, thinking, remembering, imagining, according to the language that we use and the mental faculties that we have and the conditioning that is here. That and in Vipassana, what we're looking at is that very fact that this is a compounded pattern. It's put together. And the naming of things as inside or outside, the naming of things as good or bad, as mine or yours, with the development of insight, we're looking at the very process of experience, and we're saying, oh, that's how there's a sound, and I call that outside. There's a thought, and I call that inside. There's the process of meditation, and I call it me meditating. I say there's a me, there's an I meditating. I say this is my mind, and that's you coughing. That's me over here, you over there. And with Vipassana, we're looking into how the patterns of experience are put together, and looking at the essential qualities that every pattern has. And by looking at those essential qualities, we're deliberately letting go of, well, it doesn't really matter whether it's Venerable Kachan or Venerable Titipaño or whether it's a clock or a bell. These are all, they're all in a state of change. This building is in a state of change. 3 years ago, it was an Alzheimer's Institute. Now it's a Buddhist retreat center. It's in a state of change. When it was acquired by this group, it was differently configured. Then you spent a whole bunch of money and had a lot of meetings and decided how you wanted it all to be. And now it's this shape, and you have the walls here and the staircases there, and things are done in this particular way. So we're deliberately letting go of all of the detail and say, well, it doesn't matter whether the wall was put here or put there, the walls are in a state of change. The content of what I'm saying doesn't matter. In terms of Vipassana, the particular words I'm using are not significant. The fact that they are changing, and that quality of change is, in a sense, the most fundamental universal characteristic of everything that we experience, inside or outside, coarse or fine, near or far. Everything that we experience is in a state of change. All patterns of experience are constantly changing. The second element of all experience is that of unsatisfactoriness. So we might say, oh, what a beautiful sound. And then you might say, well, I really want a bell like that. I'm going to, that's a really beautiful bell. I really want to have that. But if we heard this bell ringing like this for 10 minutes, an hour, the mind would probably find a way of screening it out. If it went on constantly, 1 hour, 10 hours, 20 hours, a week, a month, that this bell keeps going, that this sweet, delicious sound would become really irritating and probably make a lot of trips to the doctor. Say, doctor, I got this bell going in my head. It won't go away. It's this irritating Buddhist bell. It won't leave me alone. So even the most sweet and delightful experiences, they're unsatisfactory insofar as they can't remain pleasing to us. They can't, and there's no experience that we have that can be continually and permanently satisfying. Some of you might already be coming up with a few suggestions. Well, Ajahn, actually, you know, but you can make your own little list if you like. But the suggestion that the Buddha made was that if we look and if we explore, we find that there's no experience that can be owned, no experience that we can that can be felt and tasted and known that can permanently and completely satisfy. Things become boring. The mind habituates itself, even to the most delightful and delicious and beautiful. It becomes ordinary. It becomes normal. It stops being pleasing. The mind habituates itself to that level of input. And then the third characteristic of experience is that of selflessness. That when we say this is mine, this is my body or my robe or my water bottle, it's got my name on it. I didn't put their name on there, but I just saw this yesterday evening. Oh, that's mine. See, it's got my name written on it, therefore it must be mine. So, but these are just black marks on a piece of white tape. Even if I say, well, this is my water, to look at that and say, well, what's the me that's the owner? What's the bit here that actually does the owning? What shape is that? Is that male? Is it English? Is it dual nationality? How is that mine? What's the thing here that is the owner? And we realize that if we explore that all of those ways that we say this is my mind or my robe or my cushion or my retreat, my memories, that to greater and lesser degrees, all of those I's and me's and mine's, these are what I would call convenient fictions. They're useful fictions, but they're convenient fictions, like saying this is my seat. I'm the teacher, my name is on the program. So, if I came in here and Venerable Kachana was sitting in this seat with a microphone over his ear, oh. We think, oh, interesting. But the conventions are that I'm leading this retreat. So that's. But those conventions are something that we decide upon. We bring them into being. In this country, you drive on the right-hand side of the road. In Britain, you drive on the left. So that's a convention that's agreed upon, that we we take that and say, I'm driving on the correct side of the road. That's what I'm doing. And that we don't realize that, oh, that's just an agreement that we've decided upon. We've brought that into being. And something like the side of the road that you drive on is kind of obvious. That, okay, that's just an agreement. But when we think, well, but that is my memory. Well, this is my body. These are my thoughts. It can seem very convincing. These are my decisions, my choices. But with meditation and one of the great usefulnesses of Vipassana is that as we look at the process of thinking and learn to let go of that habit of identification, there can be a clearer and clearer recognition. Well, there's a memory. Memory arises, takes its shape and dissolves. But really, what makes that memory any more mine than the sound of the cars on the road, or the sound of Ajahn Amaro speaking, or the sound of the frogs and the crickets in the evening. What makes that mine? And what's this me? What's this I that is the owner? What is that? It's also helpful in looking at this to understand that the Buddha didn't put forth these what are called the three characteristics, anicca, dukkha, anatta, of impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, and not self. He didn't say these are absolute truths and you should believe in them, but more like here's a set of tools to investigate your experience, to be able to explore and to look and to see what the reality of our experience is. And so vipassana meditation, the insight, is a way of investigation. It's a way of exploring, analyzing, and in a sense deconstructing the experience of each moment. And in that deconstructing, what we find is that there's a freedom that comes when we recognize, oh, it's this, what I've been calling my pain or my problem, to be able to shift the view and say, well, no, it's pain, but it doesn't have to have an owner. It doesn't have to be me or mine. It arises, it does its thing, it fades away. The letting go of that identification and claiming of experience, the way that the mind takes hold of it and says, this is mine, this is what I am. We can look at that and see even that feeling of I, this is mine. To see, well, that feeling of mindness or I-ness is also another pattern, like the sound of a car passing by on the road. I, mine. And when those qualities of I and me and mine are also seen as empty, as passing patterns of nature, just like the shape of a cloud or a leaf that forms in spring and grows up through the summer and then falls off in the autumn, then there's a whole change of attitude towards it. So with vipassana meditation, then once the mind has arrived at a quality of steadiness and focus and can stay with the present moment in a reasonably well-established and firm way, then we consciously let go of paying attention to the feeling of the breath or the rhythm of the feet touching the ground, and to quite consciously just let the mind be open, to be non-discriminating in terms of the objects. You're not trying to focus on a particular object, but instead really you kind of broaden the range so that the whole moment becomes your object. The present reality becomes your object. And then as the mind then allows the pattern of the present to arise, take shape, sight, sound, smell, taste and touch, then as different things are noticed, like the sound of a car or a feeling in your legs or the sensation of your clothes on your skin or the sound of somebody else in the room, then seeing the mind jump in and labor, oh, that's out there, that's the road, or that's my leg, or this is my memory. And to meet every pattern of experience, to say, well, whether it's inside or outside, is it changing? whether it's coarse or fine, is it something satisfying? Is it something that could please me permanently? Is it something that's intrinsically satisfying forever? Or is it not? This memory, is it truly mine? If it's mine, what's the me that does the owning? What is that? Where is that? What shape is it? Is that sound mine? No. It's experienced here. But it's not mine. I wouldn't own the sound of that car. Okay, so why would I own this memory? Or own this plan? Huh. So we're not trying to make ourselves believe that everything is impermanent, unsatisfactory, and not self, but we're instead using these principles as tools, to like a set of magnifying glasses or kind of socket wrenches or tire levers to sort of dig into the nature of the vehicle and see how it works, and to unpick the workings of experience. And the process of doing that, because we're doing that in a deliberate and mindful, attentive way, then that, in a sense, deconstruction of the habits of ego-centered thinking, rather than being something that freaks us out or is unsettling or threatening, rather it's liberating. It's the effect of that is to free the heart and to directly experience a sense of unburdening. Well, yeah, there's a feeling of fear. It might be quite strong. It arises, it passes away. That which knows the fear is not afraid. There might be a feeling of annoyance, like that's really annoying. That which knows the annoyance is not annoyed. And something in our heart is aware of that and realizes that already. And that's like, even if the sound is very loud, like you can be sitting right by the freeway and there's a real racket, that, and it's like, it's noisy, it's really loud. Ajahn Amaro's voice is getting really loud as he's making a point. But that which knows the sound is silent. That which is knowing it is not tied, is not entangled with the object. So that which knows even intense emotional states of excitement or inspiration, that which knows excitement is not excited. That which knows irritation is not irritated. That which knows agitation is not agitated. So a symbol or a simile that Ajahn Chah used towards the end of his teaching career, he was paralyzed and couldn't speak or move for the last 10 years of his life. But during the last couple of years that he was teaching, there was a particular simile that he used to use to describe this mixture of qualities. And when people would come to visit, he liked to ask people, put kind of conundrums to them, like little impossible questions. He'd say, have you ever seen flowing water?
Yes,
the usual answer. Did you ever see still water?
Yes,
very common, yeah. Everyone's seen a river, everyone has seen sort of water sitting in a pond or in a glass. And then he would say, did you ever see still flowing water? And usually people would think,
what?
Well, that he was using some kind of local expression that they didn't understand. What was that? Did you ever see still flowing water? Nam Lai Ning. And they go, no, I don't think I ever did. He says, and then he would explain, you know, the mind is like still flowing water. It flows. We hear, we see, we feel, we remember, we think, we plan. We taste, we smell, we touch. You know, the sense world flows constantly through the mind. Even refined states, you know, deep concentration or clarity, states of great compassion or love, they flow. They arise, they take shape, they dissolve. There's constantly flowing through the mind. But that which knows the flowing states and patterns of the mind is perfectly still. It's outside of the world of time and space. That quality of awareness and knowing is not tied to the sense world, and is perfectly still because it's outside of the realm of time, of coming and going, of here and there. It's ever present, aware, awake, and free from time, free from space, free from individuality. So the mind embodies both those qualities. It's like still flowing water. There's the flow of perceptions and thoughts, and there is this profound stillness. So earlier today when I was talking about the ending of becoming, and I don't know how you did with the exercise at the mealtime, maybe you totally forgot and were just piling up the spoon, yeah, as per. I don't have spies, you know. No one was taking notes or there were no cameras on you, don't worry. But and when we talk about the ending of becoming, it doesn't mean just sort of freezing ourselves in, you know, halfway down the path. Oh, Nibbana is the ending of becoming. Can we move, Ajahn? Yeah. It's not, the ending of becoming is not stopping the world in terms of freezing, you know, stopping our speech or not moving or eating or talking. But the ending of becoming is, in a sense, it embodying that quality of stillness, embodying that awareness. Or as I was saying yesterday evening, I think, if I remember correctly, when we talk about taking refuge in Buddha, it means being that very awareness, being Buddha, being that awake, aware, knowing quality. Now, maybe the last thing to say before with this this afternoon's talk, when we practice vipassana or insight meditation, often we use the kind of language like being the witness or being the watcher or the silent watcher, that's a valid enough approach. But what can happen when we're trying to just be the witness or be the watcher of experience is that we can unconsciously create a kind of abstracted, dissociated awareness, so that we kind of unconsciously are trying to turn ourselves into a closed circuit TV camera, a sort of like a data reception unit, like thinking, seeing, hearing, feeling, and you know, that might work okay in the meditation hall, but if you try doing that over the breakfast table with your partner or your kids, or you're taking your mum out for a drive, and thinking, driving, it's not going to work. Well, the common sense of your dear mother will say, you know, why are you acting like a zombie? You know? Why don't you just talk normally? Or how come you're all kind of stiff or remote? And so that, I suggest this is a way that we can grasp the idea of watching or awareness in an incorrect way, that being aware or being awake or being the watcher is useful. But then if we cling to that or identify with that, you know, I am the watcher, or being, you know, being the one who knows, or being the watcher, then we can create this unnatural and very awkward dissociation from the sense world. We can, in a way, make the world of senses, or that kind of grubby, conditioned world. I'm just going to be wisdom. You know, all that kind of grubby, conditioned world can kind of arise and pass away. It's all over there. I don't really want to bother with that. You know, I'm into the unconditioned. And we can kind of have this sort of rejecting and nihilistic approach towards the sense world. But it's really interesting how in the qualities of the Buddha, even though he was the most sort of supremely wise and awakened being, he was also incredibly clued in to the material world. And even people who weren't his students or supporters, when they described his actions and the way he operated, they pointed out how, you know, he was extremely attentive and careful in all his actions. Everything he said, everything he did, the way he moved, the way he ate his food, the way he cleaned his alms bowl after the meal, the way he walked, everything was perfectly attuned to the time, the place, and the situation. So he was not dissociated or just kind of out of tune with the material world. And one of the characteristics, when we recite the qualities of the Buddha, one of the characteristics is, in Pali, is called Vijja Charana Sampanno. In the English version, we say perfect in impeccable in conduct and understanding, I think, in current translation. Let me have a look. Impeccable in conduct and understanding. Vijja Charana Sampanna. So Vijja means awareness. So those of you who I noticed on the go round yesterday, a few of you have been involved in Tibetan Buddhist practice. So Vijja in Pali is the same as the word Rigpa in Tibetan. It means awareness or knowing. So vijja, so the Buddha had this quality of transcendent awareness, transcendent knowing, that his mind was completely attuned to the ultimate reality. But there's also charana, means conduct, means your activity, your actions, your speech, your way of being in the world. And those two are a single, they're like a single unit, vijja charana. It's not like the charana is second rate and the vijja is the most important. But they're a unit, vijja and charana, so wisdom and conduct. And so his complete, freedom from entanglement in the world was also manifested in a complete attunement to the world. And so his actions and his words were always perfectly attuned to the time, the place, the situation. So I like to use this as an example, because it helps point the way for us when we're talking about being the one who knows or establishing the mind that's watching and aware, that is not a kind of disconnected or dissociated awareness that's sort of just trying to be this data reception unit, you know, recording the data, you know, the phenomena of our life, but it's also completely attuned. So rather than using phrases like being the watcher, I like to use the phrase unentangled participating. A few too many syllables. I like to shrink it down a bit, but like you can shrink it down to something like, you know, free action rather than reaction. But unentangled, so that the heart is unentangled, is not caught up, is not identified, but it's participating in the world. It's fully attuned to the sense world. It's not rejecting or dismissing or belittling the world of senses and the conditioned reality, but is so free that it, and that quality of freedom and awareness is fully attuned to the sense world and works in a harmonious relationship with it, rather than trying to occupy a little kind of bubble that's separated from it somewhere else. Which is also, in a way, it relates back to what I was saying about, you know, practice doesn't equal what just happens here in the hall. But it includes everything. It includes the tea time and getting in the car and driving down the freeway and talking to people, going back to work, and all of the other things, dealing with your emails that have been piling up. Yeah. And that way of meeting the world and receiving the world, our charana, our conduct, if the vijja and charana are balanced with each other, then the presence of the sense world and our responsibilities and the conditioned reality is no imposition. It doesn't inhibit our freedom. It doesn't inhibit the natural, limitless nature of the mind.